Chazor Shei Perek Yud Mishnah Aleph until Perek Yud Gimel Mishnah Dalet. Perek Yud discusses if there isn't enough money in the husband's inheritance for all his wives' ksubas, then who has precedence, who comes first to receive this? So he said that whoever is married first, they receive their ksuba first. If there's not enough, then the first wife receives hers, and so on. And in fact, even if the first wife has died, then her yorshim, her inheritors, will come before the other wives in receiving their mother's ksuba. However, if the first wife dies first, and then the husband dies, then the other wives will receive theirs first, since they're coming to receive their ksuba as a ksuba, since they're the ksuba, whereas the first wife's children and inheritors will come to collect it as ksuas benin dichrim, which is only with jabonon, that a woman's inheritors get her ksuba, but that is only jabonon, and therefore the midoraisa ksuba of the other wives comes first. The principle of ksuas benin dichrin only applies if it doesn't get rid of the midoraisa inheritance altogether, meaning if there's only enough money for the exact amount of all the mother's ksubas. If you were to give those to the inheritors, that means that is the midorabonon way of inheriting, but then there's nothing left to fulfill the midoraisa inheritance, and therefore you would have to split that equally as the midoraisa inheritance laws dictate. But if there's even one dinar extra above the amount of the ksubas, then that one dinar can fulfill the midoraisa inheritance, whereas the rest you can split according to how much each mother's ksuba was worth. Now, this extra dinar has to be owned by the father at the time that he died. If someone owed him money, that does not count towards that extra dinar. And according to Rabbi Shimon, only land is significant enough to be considered that extra dinar. If one has three wives, and one's ksubas is 100, another is 200, another is 300, and he only leaves 100, then it's split equally. Even though one had a larger ksuba, the way you work it out is that however much you have, that is how much you have a right to share in. And since all of them have 100 zuz, so all of them share that 100 zuz, that first 100 zuz equally. If you have 200 zuz, and in this case the woman who had 200 zuz as her ksuba, she said to the first one, I'm not going to have any of the first one. Then in that case, the first one would get 50 zuz because she's splitting it with only one other wife, the third wife. And then the rest of it, the other 100, the other two wives have an equal share in, and therefore each of those would get 75 zuz to make up 200 altogether. 75 plus 75 plus 50. Okay, and if there's 300 zuz, then again, the first one receives 50 zuz, because in this case, the third wife said to the first wife, I'm not going to have any of the first share, and therefore she splits it equally between the second wife and the first wife. The second lot of 100 zuz is split equally between number two and wife number two and wife number three. So therefore, wife number two gets 100 altogether, 50 from the first 100 zuz, 50 from the next 100 zuz, and wife number three gets 150 zuz. Number one, she gets 50 from the second 100 zuz. She doesn't get any from the first because she said she wouldn't. And from the last 100 zuz, she takes all of that since she's the only one who has a right to that last 100 zuz. A wife who was married after another wife, and therefore will receive her ksuba after her, she can make the first wife swear that she hasn't received any of her ksuba before, because otherwise she might be taking more, and that would stop the second wife getting any money. And according to the Tanakama, the last wife can collect her ksuba without a shavua, since everyone else has already collected their ksuba, so she's not affecting anyone by collecting hers, and therefore she doesn't need to make a shavua. However, according to Benanos, she does, in case, let's say, the first wife, she finds out that the field which she collected her ksuba from actually didn't belong to the husband, and therefore she has to give that back to the rightful owner. In such a case, she will need to recollect her ksuba, and therefore even the last wife will need to make a shvua that she hasn't received any of her ksuba, since it does affect the other wives. Even if one wife was married a few hours before another one, she's still considered to have been married before, and if it's unknown when they were married, or they were all married at the same time, or the ksuba was written at the same time, then you split it equally between all the wives. We know there's a concept of achrayis nechosim, that all a husband's property, even that which he's sold, if he doesn't have enough money when he dies or is divorced to pay her ksuba, she will be able to collect that money from the field which he sold. Now, if one of the wives said to the buyer of the husband's field, that she won't claim her ksuba from there, then she can't, but another wife still can, and therefore, if the second wife claims it from the buyer, then the first wife can claim it from the second wife, since now it belongs to the second wife, not the buyer. And once it belongs to the first wife, then the buyer can claim it from the first wife, since the first wife said she can't have precedence over the buyer. And then you go round in circles until they come to a compromise, meaning until they agree that they're going to split it. And the same would be true if someone lends someone money and the person who borrowed the money sold two of his fields to someone else, and the lender said to one of those buyers that he's not going to have a claim to him. Again, it all goes round in circles until they come to a compromise. And also, if a woman is owed money as her ksuba, and instead of there being another wife there's another buyer there. Basically, anyone who is owed money, the same laws would apply, and they'd have to come to a compromise. Perek Yud Aleph discusses a woman who sells her husband's inheritance to be supported by that. And we said, firstly, the husband's inheritors have to support her, and in return for that, they receive her maaseh yodeha, whatever she earns and makes, just like the husband did. Now that they're supporting her, they receive that right. But they're potter from bearing her. However, a shomeres yovam, someone whose husband has died and she's waiting for yibam and chalitza, her ksuba is inherited by the husband's heirs once she dies, and therefore in return for that, they would be obligated to bury her. The Mishnah then said that she can sell the property either for her ksuba or to be supported, and she does not need to do it in front of Beis Din, since the husband would not have wanted her to humiliate herself by going to Beis Din, so she doesn't need to go to Beis Din, she can sell it outside Beis Din. But according to Rabbi Shimon, if she was only engaged to him, or she's received part of her ksuba, in which case she's not supported by him, since in both these cases she can only sell it for the ksuba, that means it's going to be a one-time payment, a one-time sale. She's not going to go constantly and sell it again, like if she was doing it for food, and therefore she does have to do it in Beis Din, since it's not so humiliating to do it just once. The Mishnah advised that she should write what she's selling it for, so that people don't think she's always buying food, because then it will be more difficult for her to get married after that. And then we said a gerusha, or someone who is divorced, she does need to sell in Beis Din, since her husband would not have minded her being humiliated by going there. If her ksuba was 200 zuz and she sold something worth 200 zuz for 100 zuz, or 100 zuz for 200 zuz, either way, either she's received her ksuba or she spent the value belonging to the inheritors, she's spent 200 zuz of theirs because she sold something worth 200 zuz. Even if she only received 100 zuz, she's received her ksuba, she cannot get any more. If she sold something worth more than the value of her ksuba, then it's invalid because she has no right over that. And this is even if she's willing to pay back that extra bit. And in contrast to Shimon Gamliel, it would be valid unless there's a significant difference, meaning if it's considered like a whole garden worth or a field worth that she underpriced and she sold, which she didn't have the right to, only then would it be invalid. But if it's less than that, then it would be valid. We then talked about onoa, which means over or underpricing, which would make the sale invalid. And we said if it's a normal person selling it for her or even her, then even if it's one dinar extra or under the price, it would be invalid. But if it's the Beis Din selling it, then since Beis Din have a bigger right and more strength, only if it's a sixth of the value over or under price, only then would it be invalid. And if Beis Din announced that they were selling it and people came to value the property as well, since they made this announcement, that gets rid of the halacha of Ainoa, and therefore the sale would all always be valid. And a contribution from Gamliel, Beis Din sale is always valid, not if it's unless it's not a sixth, but a half or double. Yeah, according to the Tanakama, if they charge a sixth over or under the price, then it's invalid. According to Shimon Gamliel, it's only if they charge double or half the amount, only then would it be invalid. We then discussed three women who don't have a right to ksuba, and similarly a few other things like compensation for what the husband had from their inheritance, you know, the payos, and being supported by him, and him having to pay back for the things he wore out. And those three women were, number one, a memo enes, someone who performed mion, and mion is again where a ketana nullifies her marriage by refusing and just walking out. It's as if they were never married before. Since they were never married, the husband will not need to give her ksuba. And number two was an erev drabonon, someone whom a drabonon you're not allowed to marry because they're related to you, and she doesn't get these things as a punishment. And thirdly, an ilonis, someone who can't have children. If she didn't tell the husband that she can't have children before they were married, then again the marriage would be invalid, and therefore she does not get her ksuba and the other things. But whereas an erev drabonon would not get these things, if you marry someone, not a relative, but someone else who you're not allowed to marry d'oraisa, you would get the ksuba, because we have the rule of divrei sofrim tzrichim chizuk, that things which are midrabbonon, they need strengthening and punishing if people transgress them, because people are less careful about those things, and therefore in some cases are going to be even more strict with midrabbonon halachos. Perek Yud Beis began by discussing if at the time of marriage the woman makes a condition with the husband that he needs to support her daughter from a previous marriage for 5 years, then even if he gets divorced within those 5 years, he has to continue supporting her. And if this daughter's mother goes and marries someone else and makes the same condition, then they'll both have to support her at the same time. meaning one supports her, the husband, the current husband needs to support her, and the previous husband of her mother needs to pay her the value which he would have to spend to support her. And if the daughter gets married, then her actual husband will have to support her, and the other two, her mother's two husbands, will need to give her the value. And if those husbands die, then their actual daughters only can get their ksuba, sorry, they can only be fed from food which, from his actual inheritance. But this daughter can even take food from Nechosim Meshubodim, which means property which he's sold already. Since she's owed money, she's considered a Baal Chayv, and therefore she can take from Nechosim Meshubodim. A widow is allowed to live in her husband's previous house, and she can get the same honor and live in the same style as she did when her husband was alive, but she only is supported if she lives there. If she chooses to live in her father's house, then the inheritors can support her, give her less money for food, since it would cost them less if she was with them in the same house. According to Rabbi Meir, in the name of Moshe Ben Gamliel, she can only collect her ksuba up to 25 years if she lives in her husband's house, since she would do favors for people up to 25 years, the value of her ksuba. But according to the Chachot, it was if she lived in her father's house that she can only do up to 25 years, because then she would not be embarrassed to ask for the ksuba, and the fact that she hasn't asked for the ksuba means that she's been moichel, she's forgiven them, and she's forgone that right. And if she dies, then her inheritors can mention it for up to 25 years. As long as they mention it once within those 25 years, they can receive it. If they don't, then that means they've forgiven her, since they're definitely not being supported by them, so they will not be embarrassed. And the fact that they haven't mentioned it must be because they have forgone their right. Mishnah Gimel told us two halachas of Chonon ben Avishalom. Number one, that if someone's husband goes away and she comes to Beis Din and wants to be supported, she doesn't need to swear that the husband didn't give her food already. It's only if people come and say he's died and she wants to receive her ksuba, only then would she need to swear that she hasn't received anything from the husband. And the second halacha was that if he goes away and someone voluntarily supports her, then the husband comes back, he would be potter from repaying him, since he didn't ask him to do it and it was purely voluntary. We then brought the first two of seven halachas from Admon, and the first one was that if someone dies and leaves an inheritance which is not big enough to support both the sons and the daughters, according to Admon, the sons have priority, since they always have priority, since when they get inheritance and the daughters don't. So just like there, they have priority, so too here. And secondly, we came to the concept of moed b'miktzas. If someone admits to owing someone part of the claim which he says he owes him, then he has to swear. And if someone says, you owe me jugs of oil, according to Admon, jugs is part of that claim, and therefore if he admits to owing the jugs, he would have to swear that he does not owe him the oil as well.